I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, who were the first Texans? We're learning that there were people living and thriving in Texas maybe as long as 20,000 years ago, much longer than previously thought. The discoveries at a 30-acre spot in central Texas known as the Galt Site tells the story of what might be the earliest humans on the continent. The Galt Site is located in central Texas, about 40 miles north of Austin, and it's a location littered with stone tools and weapons, even art. For much of the 20th century, the Galt Site was privately owned and heavily looted, destroying history. A new documentary that airs tonight on KLRN tells the story of the discoveries at Galt and also the extraordinary effort to preserve it. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The deep, rich history of Texas and the earliest peopling of this continent are revealing itself, and one of the most significant locations for learning about the first humans in North America is called the Galt Site, about 40 miles north of Austin. But it was a location that was so looted by amateur collectors that it was considered exhausted and not worth serious exploration, and that assumption was so wrong. In the new documentary, The Stones Are Speaking, we learn about the amazing discoveries at the Galt Site and the man, archaeologist Mike Collins, who risked it all on saving Galt. The Stones Are Speaking airs tonight on KLRN, our local public television station, at 10 p.m. And we're joined by Olive Talley. She is the award-winning producer, writer, director behind The Stones Are Speaking. Olive, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And also with us is archaeologist John Loesch. He is board president of the Galt School of Archaeological Research. And John, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with Olive and to visit with you today.
Yeah, so we have an hour to dig into the science and also the story. But real quickly, tell me what was found at the Galt site, John, that was so different, that changed everything?
So the Galt site's got a long history of research, some of it controlled and scientifically conducted, most of it not, of course, but I think the kind of the bellwether moment was the report from late 90s, maybe as early as 1990, about the discovery of what we would call Clovis artifacts associated with small limestone cobbles that showed engraving on them. So the notion that what people may have thought at that time were the earliest folks in North America, had the capacity and the wherewithal to express thoughts and ideas on engraved stone media, you know, together with just hunting mammoth and other things that were required for survival, was a pretty new revelation. And I think that really kind of opened the door for what we're here to talk about, you know, the kind of the wave of work that was done, invested at the Galt site. But the sites told a story not just about Clovis, and helped dispel the notion that Clovis peoples were the first ones to be in the New World, but has also kind of really helped to shape our paradigm about what folks were doing here and how long they might have been before Clovis. And so the story gets more complex and more complex the more we learn, the more we learn that we have yet to find out.
Olive Talley, how did you get involved? What got you thinking about doing a documentary and then seeing it all the way through?
Well, David, you may not believe this, but the story of Galt began in Antarctica. I was on a trip to Antarctica in 2017, where I saw a presentation by National Geographic photographer Kenneth Garrett, and he was talking about the peopling of the Americas, and he put this name of this site with a red star on a map of Texas, and we were all intrigued. What is the Galt site? And there were several Texans on this trip, and none of us had ever heard of this place. We just were really surprised to learn that such an important place was located in Texas. And I wondered, why had I, a reporter who had stomped around and covered a lot of Texas for many, many decades. How did I miss this story? How did I not know that this was here? And I began to talk and question my neighbors and friends. Nobody else had heard of it either. So I thought, I want to know if this is, one, really true. Is this a pivotal site? And two, why don't we know more about it? And that's what launched the journey.
And so as you started digging in, when did you get
started? And I love that pun, digging
and,
in.
And when did you first make contact with Mike Collins?
As soon as I came back from Antarctica, I called him up and we talked for 4 hours on the phone and I was hooked. And David, to be honest, I thought I would just do a little print story because I'm a former newspaper reporter in addition to being a radio and wire service reporter and a television producer. But I thought, I'll just whip out a little story about this. But they did not have the final dates on the site. They were waiting on a lot of tests to come back with definitive or the most definitive dates that they could get. So unfortunately, I got distracted by another documentary that I was working on. They finished and concluded the dates and then reported those in a Science Advances article. And so I thought, well, I've missed out because I didn't get my story out in print prior to the publication of those dates. But then a number of factors intervened and the discussion came up about a documentary. And I, for better or worse, said, sure, why not? So
yeah,
it really conveys, you know, a film, as you know, we love the intimacy of radio and we love shows like yours, but film can convey emotion and visuals in ways that you cannot achieve in print or radio. So I felt like the best format to tell this story, which is a biography and a mystery and a historical narrative all rolled into one. And I just thought film and, you know, television and broadcasting was the best way to convey all of that.
So, John, it's been established that, you know, Clovis, named after the site in New Mexico where they found the Clovis rocks and also remains of a Columbian mammoth there. And that became like the term used for the culture. And then the discovery of that in Central Texas, that was already known, but it was just seen that this was an abundant site for Clovis.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, David. The term Clovis, you know, is used by archaeologists to describe a culture. The truth is that there are probably lots of cultures or regional variations of culture that are rolled up into what archaeologists call Clovis. And so, you know, we kind of struggle to grasp the variability, but we also have struggled for a long time because Clovis sites that help us understand what these peoples were like. Are really scarce on the landscape. Very, very few of those are kind of known, and even fewer have been controlled or excavated under controlled conditions. Most of them, you know, really only contain a small sort of assemblage, just a few handfuls of flake stone tools, you know, maybe a little bit more, but nothing on the scale of what apparently came to be known at the Galt site or from the Galt site. So the site itself is, as more work was done, as more work's done, it's not just that Clovis is there, which is a big story, of course, but so much of it is there. You know, the density, the complexity of the site, the variability of the material remains in there really helped to kind of break open our incomplete understandings of what these early peoples were like and forced us to explore the notion that, you know, they had concepts that you and I might connect with, like home bases, home territories. They weren't just sort of scampering across the landscape, you know, struggling to survive. They had routines and they had practices and they had, you know, habits and rituals and cultural practices and relationships that spanned across a continent, right? And we're sort of privileged over time to have been able to work at Galt and to kind of see an example of what one of those central campsites looks like, where we see, you know, evidence of, I'll say, you know, adults training children and different people from different regions coming together and getting to know each other. And we can imagine, you know, all the social relationships and connections that, yeah, that were formed along the way. It's really an unparalleled opportunity, or has been an unparalleled opportunity.
So we're going to be talking more about that when we come back from the break. Okay. Phone lines are open. If you have a question about the Clovis and the culture and the Galt site and the archaeology in Texas, the earliest peopling here, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The story of the Galt site, and it could have been a story, a tragedy, talking about what could have been, what was lost, because we never were able to get organized and actually explore and preserve the history of that location. Instead, it was left to people to loot and just sort of, scramble all over the history and not really harvest the information that we need. Instead, the story is one of a groundbreaker of Mike Collins, an archaeologist who risked it all to save Galt. He risked his professional reputation and also his own resources, his own money, in order to save that location. It's a story that is told in the documentary The Stones Are Speaking. It airs tonight on KLRN-TV, our local PBS station, at 10 o'clock. And we're joined by Olive Talley. She is the writer, director, the producer of the documentary, and also by archaeologist John Loesch. And if you got a question or a comment about the earliest peopling of the Americas, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, John, why has it always been so controversial to keep pushing back that date when we had the first initial peopling of the Americas? It used to be in the 1800s that it was 4,000 years ago, nothing before 4,000 years ago. And if you said different, then you were cast out of the clubhouse of the Smithsonian. And now they had Clovis, they were able to establish one thing, and now pre-Clovis is being established as now the marker. Why? But that still has run into a lot of interference. Why so hard to explore this new information?
Well, David, I think that's a great question. It kind of goes back to the nature of science and scientific inquiry, I believe. A site like Galt, which is really the gold standard for Clovis research, has so much to tell us. I think as we work hard our careers, and I'll speak, individually, as I sort of spend years toiling in the field, building sets of ideas and bodies of data, those ideas and the models mean a lot to me. And I think there's a kind of a communal effect. And if you get a cohort of folks that believe in the same ideas and the models, and their careers are invested in the truthfulness of those models, to have that sort of body of knowledge challenged and questioned can be a big sort of topic of conversation, and for a lot of folks very sensitive as well. So I think it's the nature of scientific discourse to a degree, and unfortunately those models, as archaeologists, as scientists, we change our minds very, very slowly. We expect high standards of proof and evidence before we can acknowledge that maybe what we presented last year or 10 years ago isn't quite right or isn't completely right. And so I think there was a kind of a sociological effect, to be honest, that kept the field from changing over time. I would say unfortunately, but I mean, there's a very positive benefit to that. A lot of questionable findings weren't really admitted into the academy. So there's a little bit of good and a little bit of bad. The bad part is that we have been very, very slow to acknowledge the depth of human presence in the new world. But the good part is that what we think we know, we've got a pretty high standard of confidence in that. So it goes both ways.
Why are we still?
David,
yes.
Go may ahead. I just jump in, yes, and make one other point? and again, I want your audience to understand that the Galt site is really the major Clovis site in North America. And John, help me out here, but There were more Clovis artifacts discovered and unearthed at Galt than any other single site in the North America continent. North America, right, John? It's more than all of the other sites put together. And when Mike Collins walked out there in 1998 at the request of the second landowners that he dealt with, and they had found this mammoth mandible that they didn't know what it was, he says in the film he saw more Clovis artifacts lying in the back dirt where they had already dug out stuff at the site than he had ever seen in his entire career. And this is a man who had largely devoted his career to studying Clovis artifacts. So, I want your audience to understand this was a pivotal discovery. And it that was just the beginning of changing that dialogue. John, did I get that right?
Yeah, it's a really incredible deposit. So rich, and it goes on and on, you know, and as I mentioned a second ago and saying the film, you know, it really is the gold standard for how we understand some Clovis sites to be.
And so we keep talking about Clovis artifacts. So we're talking about, flint hand axes, scrapers for like leather, things to cut, meat and other puncture leather. What do we have there, John? What is there?
So what we see, you know, are the stone tools, the chip stone or the shape stone or flint that's left behind. We all know, you know, that perishable materials, clothing, fiber, organic remains objects and items were part of their toolkit as well. Unfortunately, most of that will never preserve in an archaeological site. It's what we have behind are the imperishable remains, the stone artifacts that were tools and themselves used to create and fashion other tools. And so from just a small part of the puzzle of what these people had with them, you know, is what we get to work with. That's the stone tools. And so spear points, as you said, scrapers, knives, anything, any tool. If you went into your toolbox in your garage, you know, you had hammers and cutters and scrapers and gougers and puncturers and stuff. There are equivalents to all of that stuff in these prehistoric toolkits, and nearly all of them were made out of chip stone flint.
Let's go to a caller, George. George, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Morning, David. Listen, you have a great show here right now. I'm an artist, and a few years ago I was commissioned to do a video study of for the NAFTA project, and part of the project included trying to see how long there had been trade between the indigenous peoples from the Arctic Circle down to Central America as proof that it was free trade existed for many, many thousands of years. I worked with the Smithsonian, and they showed me piles of Clovis points that they had unearthed or from north of the Arctic Circle, from the Yukon, from Vancouver area, Minnesota, Connecticut areas. And they assume that Clovis points became a form of currency among early traders and migratory groups. But these excavations were at sites that were post-Clovis culture. And so do y'all have evidence of just how valuable were these tools and items that came from the Clovis culture?
All right, George, thank you for that call. John, and is there anything about that particular flint deposit that can be traced, that one location, and has that been tracked across the continent?
To a degree, yes. We can identify flint or chert from different outcrops geologically that may occur across the United States by different means. We can't trace it, I would say, chemically as precise as we can other stones like obsidian, you know, volcanic glass that's sort of specific to each eruption event. But chert can be identified by visual characteristics and to a lesser degree by geochemical means. We do see these materials moving, I would say, across large distances on the continental landscape. We know or infer that some of these objects were, you know, fashioned as tools and then changed hands between one hunter-gatherer group and another. So that probably accelerates the way or the degree to which they travel across the landscape. Defining them as currency is an interesting concept. I think, you know, we would have a trouble to ascribe a value or to kind of calibrate a value to those. We can acknowledge that they had social value or held meaning like that, but what they were worth is a different question. But yeah, for sure, this is a kind of a way that groups did communicate with each other and interact together across the continent.
David, we see at the Galt site, one of the first pieces that got Mike Collins' attention and drew him to the site it was, the collector called it a hot dog and a bun. There were two engraved stones, and sandwiched between them was a point that was made out of chert that came out of the Alabates area up in the panhandle. So again, that's just one example, small example, yet a firm example of the fact that, you know, people were mobile, and people, whether they were trading or carrying it with them, I don't know. But you have examples of different types of quartz. It was even a smoky quartz. What was it? A blade, a little blade, a little point fragment.
Yeah.
So you have different types of chert found at Galt and materials that were not the Edwards limestone chert that was predominant at Galt.
And John, there is art found at that location, which is astonishing. What did that look like? And how common is that art style around the world?
What it looked like is a little bit easier to answer, David. The media available to these peoples were small, and by small, I mean like the size of the palm of your hand, for example, limestone sort of cobbles or flat rocks. And on the surfaces of some of these, they would engrave or etch lines. In some cases, they're geometric patterns. In some cases, they look a little bit more random, you know, almost arbitrary. Probably some of these objects may have been used as, you know, tools themselves, but we know without a shadow of a doubt that many, many, many of these cases from Galt represent the expression of ideas of some kind.
But it's a decorative pattern?
Some of those are decorative patterns. There's a lot of them are geometric in fashion or in shape or design, but there's a lot of decorative stuff. There's a lot of kind of, I don't think that they adhere to a particular style, you know, but it is the expression of ideas on stone media. And those from Clovis context, when we've excavated several of those from the site, are believed to be the earliest expressions of this kind of artistic, you know, behavior in the New World.
Go ahead, Olive.
Sorry, I keep jumping in.
That's good. I like it.
Okay. At one point, the Galt site was better known in Europe and in Asia because of the interest in the engraved stones. And so papers have been written about this. Clark Wernicke, Ashley Lemke, Dr. Collins, I think three of them co-authored a paper about this, which, you know, can be found out there in the literature. But the engraved stones were an intriguing, compelling piece of the Galt story.
Right. People have wondered, like, is it a form of communication? Is it a form of accounting? Has anything to do with the stars? You know, what's going on with these, with Olive, what do you think up with those carvings?
I don't know, but that's one of the wonders and the marvels of this kind of work. It just engages you. It sparks your curiosity. It drives you to ask more questions. We don't have all the answers to the questions, but the more questions we ask, we can hope for more answers. So I just think it's part of the intrigue of the entire place.
Well, John, how does you, when you see this, we have all the work, all the handiwork, the tools that were made and weapons and other artifacts, but to see art, how does that change the impression of these people?
On the one hand, David, I think it kind of opened our eyes and was a bit of a stunner, right? But as Olive notes, you know, the artistic traditions are better known for the same time periods in the world, right? So we're talking about 13,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, in the old world, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago. Those traditions are a whole lot better known in Asia and Europe. And to scholars over there, it's not such a surprise. But if you have the opportunity to go to a world-class rock art site like Lascaux in France, for instance, or several in Spain, you'll see some incredible artistic expressions. These are the same modern human beings, Homo sapiens sapiens, that were not the same individuals, but the same species that were living at Galt and scattered across the North American continent. So the capacity for artistic expression should not have been a surprise. The discovery of the artistic expression was a surprise, but I think if we kind of sit for a minute and we think, well, what are modern human beings elsewhere on the globe doing at 20 to 18 to 16,000 years ago? They're doing stuff exactly like this. And so, yeah, in hindsight, maybe, you know, should we have been surprised? It's a neat discovery at the time, but it makes perfect sense in the global context.
Well, Texas is no slouch when it comes to rock art also, the ancient art. We'll talk about that some also. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There's a 30-acre spot in central Texas. It's become known around the world for upending ideas about when the first peoples came to the Americas. The Galt site, located in central Texas near the border of Williamson and Bell County, north of Austin, is one of the most significant archaeological sites in North America for understanding the early peopling of the continent. Tonight, there is a documentary that tells the story of the site and of the extraordinary effort, the extraordinary man, Mike Collins, who risked it all to save Galt and is now, preserved. And it's on KLRN-TV tonight, your local PBS station, at 10 p.m. We're joined by the producer, the director, the writer of the documentary, Olive Talley, and also archaeologist John Loge. He is the board president of the Galt School of Archaeological Research. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Olive Talley, let me ask you about this. The looting of this location is interesting and tragic. But how did that happen? Was it like basically people would show up, they'd pay a fee to the landowner, and they would take a shovel and just start digging holes and just to find what they thought may have been arrowheads or something?
Yes, you understand well, David, but it goes back about 70 years. It started toward, you know, the early 1900s, when the original landowner at that time, Henry Galt, was trying to farm there. And it's hard scrabble. It's rocky. And he would take some vegetables into town on a wagon. And there was a scout who was working with J.E. Pierce, who was one of the, I guess, the father of archaeology in some senses in Texas. And he was a professor who founded the anthropology department at UT. And so this person who always had his ears open and eyes open for leads on archaeology, all things archaeology, he ran into Henry Galt, so the story goes, out on the drag in Austin, and Henry Galt would bring in these artifacts and these arrowheads. And one thing led to another. J.E. Pierce went out, did an excavation of the site back in the late 20s, and found it to be a phenomenal site. And in fact, he thought it was so important and so amazing that he urged the National Park Service to save it, to buy it and save it and preserve it as a national park. That didn't happen. It was during the Depression. There was no money and no appetite for this. And so then people would jump the fence. People began to hear about it. And then in the 40s, he sold the land to the Lindsay family. And Elmer Lindsay and Neely Lindsay at the time started running it as a pay dig. And Elmer was the nephew of Neely. And Elmer started really running it formally as a pay to dig. So you could give him $25, you'd get the key, you'd go in, and just as you described, David, you got your shovel, you could dig, whatever you found, you kept. And it became a magnet for collectors. And then it was a collector, really, who we have, you know, to thank for really ringing the bell, a collector and an artifact expert up in Illinois, a guy named Pete Bostrom. This collector, David Olmsted, found these engraved stones in the context of Clovis points, and he knew enough to recognize that he had something important. And he sent them off to a lithics casting lab, and Pete Bostrom, who had done lithics casting, as in making, you know, copies, not for nefarious reasons, but for scientific reasons, to be able to preserve the original specimen and then have a copy you could show your buddies and other people. So Pete Bostrom calls down to UT and basically, as Tom Hester says in the film, do you Texas archaeologists know what the hell is going on down there in your backyard? There's a guy who's collected Clovis points and engraved stones, and what are y'all doing about it? So that's when Mike Collins and Tom Hester went out there and saw this place for the first time. Mike saw it for the first time in 1991. Tom Hester had previously been out there a couple of years before that to scout it as a possible teaching site for a field school for the summer for students and avocational archaeologists. And they really saw nothing that they could retrieve. And they wrote it off as you had said in your good intro, as exhausted and depleted and pretty much worthless to science. But so, Mike Collins saw something different.
I'm going to pick up on all that, but I want to go to a caller here. We have Ryan, and Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, I actually have a question that's perfect for what Olive was just talking about. So my wife and I, we have some property in Central Texas, and we come across a lot of artifacts in the form of points and chert and various other things. And we've had a lot of difficulty in finding anybody to speak to provide some kind of, say, archaeological or educational assessment. Are there resources or a direction that you could point us for who to talk to about something like that?
Ryan, thank you for the call. And John, do you want to pick that up? And do you want me to connect you to Ryan?
Well, I'm happy to kind of respond to that. The Texas Historical Commission, part of their program involves public outreach, and they sort of manage a steward of avocational volunteers that are statewide. They're called Archaeological Stewards, the Archaeological Stewards Network. So if you call the Texas Historical Commission, they can connect you with an expert in your region. And their assignment is to help landowners, curious and interested landowners, understand what they have and help document and maybe even lead to the conservation of those resources.
All right, so I hope that helps you, Ryan. John, I want to pick up on what we're hearing from Olive about the looting of that site. And if you can help us understand what that means in terms of the destruction of history, why getting a shovel and digging a hole and pulling out Clovis points and things, how that is a bad idea.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak to that. And we need to understand archaeology is inherently a destructive science. And so when we excavate sites, as Mike Collins says in the film, when we take those apart, you know, we kind of disassemble those and you can't put them back together again. So when we excavate a site in controlled fashion, we are destroying it. But the difference is that there's a lot of careful notes, a lot of photography that's done along the way so that we're recording and we're putting back together the relationships in space between, let's say, artifact one and artifact two, or between the Clovis artifacts and the engraved stones that David Olmsted reported. And when you take a shovel and you dig sort of in an uncontrolled manner, those relationships in space are lost. They're not ever documented or recorded. And it's those connections between the artifacts or the objects in the archaeological sort of matrix of the soil that tells us most of the story. We can know something about the past just by looking at an object, but I would say it's 5% of the story, 10% of the story. When we see that object together with the rest of the tools that it was used with, or together with the bones that it was used to process, or with the campfire that it was used to help help make life, that tells us the full story. And so I think it's the uncontrolled excavation where we lose those connections between the objects in the ground.
And the word is context, John. You know, when I first began talking to Mike and learning about archaeology, I can't even tell you how many times, context, context, context. Everything is about context. And that is the damage that many well-meaning people do. I mean, private landowners certainly have the power and the control over their land. They will not lose their land by working with an archaeologist or a scientist. They can't take it away from them. And that is a fear that I think is very rampant among a lot of collectors. Fear that their land will somehow be confiscated. And that just isn't going to happen in the state of Texas. But if we can bring collectors and landowners and private individuals together and have them work with scientists and archaeologists, we have the potential to learn a lot more about our shared history as humans. And that's what I hope the film can encourage people. Mike Collins did not see the Lindsays as bad people. To the contrary, he liked them a lot and he worked with them. So it was not about denigrating them. It was not about castigating them. It was not about judging them. It was about educating them. And the more they learned and the more they understood what they were doing, they themselves came to believe and admitted on camera in the film, we were destroying history and we just didn't really realize, you know, what we were doing. And that education was the catharsis. The education was what propelled them to say, hey, we don't want to do this. We love collecting, and they still have a collection of things that they've dug up, but they wanted to contribute to our greater knowledge. And I think a lot of that can happen. And man, there is great history and many, many untold stories and many undiscovered sites in Texas. Right, John?
Yeah, we have a lot to learn, that's for sure.
All right, so we're going to take another break. We'll get back to the phones. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've got a question or a comment about the documentary, airs tonight at 10 p.m. on KLRN, our local PBS station. The Stones are speaking about the amazing discoveries at the Galt site and the man responsible for preserving it, archaeologist Mike Collins. Going to hear about more about him and how he risked it all to save Galt. And we're taking a break and we'll be right back. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new documentary film airs tonight on KLRN, our local PBS station. The Stones are speaking. It airs tonight at 10 o'clock. We're joined by the producer, the writer, the director, Olive Talley, and also with John Loess. He is a professional archaeologist for more than 30 years, and he is on the board of the Galt School of Archaeological Research. So, John, let me take this call first before I lose track of him. Anthony, let's get you on the air. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hello there. I heard the discussion earlier about, you know, who to contact if he found like a site, but I'm curious as to if there was a site that was destroyed intentionally, who would you report that to? The story goes that there was a development going on and some surveyors found some caves with the pictographs inside and all kinds of points and tools inside those caves, and they were told to destroy them, and the server and the company that was developing that area told these surveyors, you know, don't say anything or you'll lose your job. So it's my understanding that they collapsed these caves and you know, never to be seen again.
Wow. Anthony, thank you for that. John, what should we do about something like that?
That's sure a sad story, isn't it, David? I'm going to tell you that's probably not a surprising story, and I have no doubt that stuff like that happens all the time. In Texas, you know, the laws that protect cultural resources, archaeological sites, whether it's, you know, pictographs or stone tools, animal bone remains, they depend heavily on property ownership. And so on private property in the state of Texas, private property rights are very, very important and sort of sacred to us. If a housing developer or some other project owner owns that land outright and is a private entity, it is the truth that they can treat those resources how they want to. We all hope that there's a bit of a conservation ethic that's involved, you know, that we can appreciate the opportunities to learn from the past and what those resources and those educational moments may mean to the community. But the fact is that under law, private landowners can do kind of what they want to. The difference is human remains and cemeteries. That's not necessarily a private property rights issue. That's a state law issue under the health and safety code. So that's a different matter. So the question by your caller to whom to report that, you know, if it's something that happened years ago, I would say there's nobody to report that to. But the project, if it's privately owned and privately funded, you know, that's just the way it goes. And the best thing that I think that we can do is to work collaboratively for a little bit more of a kind of enlightened view on what this stuff means, and hope for the best. For sinkholes, though, if those are openings into aquifers and protected watersheds, that's a different story. I'm not a, watershed expert, so I don't know quite the answer to that. But in terms of archaeology, you know, that's kind of how it goes a lot of the times in Texas, unfortunately.
Olive Talley, Olive Talley, let me ask you this.
Hold on. I'm a journalist, and I believe that there is always the power of public information. And so while there may not be a specific agency to go to and complain to, I would urge the caller and anyone else, if this is happening now, and if there can be any documentation of this, then it should be a matter of public shaming. And so put it out there, get it out there, contact your local historical preservation organization in your city, in your county, and wherever. Call me. I'll do something. I don't know what, but I'll do something. We'll, so, we'll have a show on David. We'll do another show, David, on
the sure. Yeah. So Olive, the, you know, iconography of Texas, you know, whether it be the football helmet or the cowboy hat or what the longhorn. You know, this is all part of Texas. This is Texas identity that we should be focusing on and elevating. We should be thinking about the Clovis points as part of, you know, iconography of Texas, and also this rich rock art that we have in Texas that's incredibly, you know, thousands of years old and incredibly intricate and extremely just beautiful to the eye. That's should be preserved, and we should be cherished, and it should be part of being a Texan.
Yes, yes, hallelujah, amen. I totally agree. And, you know, the work that Carolyn Boyd and the Shumla organization are doing down in the lower Pecos Canyonlands, the stuff that the Whitty Museum is doing there in San Antonio to help preserve and promote the rock art, it's fabulous, fabulous stuff. You'll see one tiny short little clip because we've shot some and we've filmed some with Carolyn, and we thought about doing a documentary about that too. But
the White Shaman.
Yes, the White Shaman Cave, the Panther Cave, all that stuff down there. It is phenomenal. Now, it is not as old as what you see at Galt. It is not prehistoric, but they are showing, and they've done the research. They can interpret these murals, which they call books. And the Huichol tribe, shamans from the Huichol tribe in Mexico, have come down and started talking to the figures that are painted on the walls in these rock art in these rock shelters down on the Pecos. And anyway, it's phenomenal. We have incredible history here, and we need to save it.
Let's go to a caller, Javier. Javier, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Hey, I wanted to know if your caller, if your speakers knew the story about, I had heard a while back that the, in the Four Corners area of the United States, there was this viejito, he owned, I don't know if he owned hundreds or thousands of acres in that area. And there was an indigenous group from that era that he had. His ranch was full of artifacts. I mean, I heard they were in pristine condition, and he let some guy in, and but he started digging, and the old man got PO'd, and get out of here, broke the guy's pick and ran him off later on when the real, I guess, architects, archaeologists came in. They said it was in pristine condition. Do they know the story about
right,
that?
Javier, thank you for the call. And so I'm sure this is apocryphal, but, you know, Olive, John, does it sound familiar?
Well, I don't know of this particular story, but clearly your caller is absolutely right that the Four Corners is a rich, rich depository. And you will see in our film, again, a few seconds of video of a place called the Wallace Ruin, which is a Chaco outlier very near, really in the shadow of the Mesa Verde site. And one of the archaeologists, Bruce Bradley, who worked closely with Mike on the Galt site, is doing that. And it's just a rich depository of cultural sites. And it's wonderful.
John Loesch, let's talk about Mike Collins. And when he decided that he was going to go all in on Galt, he said, this is the location. This is the site. We're going to be able to make some amazing discoveries here. It seems like he was going against the current, against the what most people thought. They were saying, why? Why would you want to go there? It's already been, you know, contaminated. It's not worth your time.
Well, I think that's true. The initial sort of understanding was that the site was played out. Of course, that proved to be untrue. I think most of the backlash that Mike got from his professional peers, though, was in the way that he engaged the landowners. And a minute of work at the site, of course, proved that the site was not played out, you know, so the scientific merit was there. The problematic issue for some archaeologists was, you know, engaging with landowners who were involved in digging, collecting, destroying the site, and that kind of what seemed on the surface as a compromise of ideals and of principles was a little bit hard for some archaeologists in Texas to understand and to agree with. And Mike did face a lot of pushback and a lot of backlash for that. The way that access to the site was negotiated, you know, between him and the landowners also involved money. And a lot of folks didn't understand the point of that or the value in that. You know, again, these are private property rights issues and access issues and all sort of reasoned out under law. So, you know, Mike was a very principled guy, very inspirational in that regard. And I think the way the history has turned out, you know, has had a lot to say in his favor. And, you know, for archaeologists, that's a journey that each of us needs to make, how we understand the importance of working with private property owners and landowners and collectors. Some of my colleagues are more comfortable with that. Some are less comfortable with that. I understand the full spectrum. But in the case of Galt, in the case of Mike Collins, I'll say, you know, on the record that a lot of the backlash that he faced was over the top in historical context, not quite on the right side of the story. And I would say, you know, we're all very, very thankful that Mike stood his ground and stood by his principles for the protection and preservation of Galt.
And Olive Talley can talk about how Mike did go all in and used his own resources to preserve that location.
Yes, it is. Mike is one of the most ethical people you will ever meet. Science and the facts and the truth are the absolute benchmark by which he lives. And there's just no question about that. But what a lot of archaeologists just didn't feel like it was ethical to pay a lease to be able to do a scientific dig. And so that's the line that he was treading on that some perceived that to be wrong. But as John said, he went the distance, and he did this not for his own self-benefit. He didn't do this for self-gain. He didn't do this for self-aggrandizement and making a name for himself. Instead, he brought in and allowed all sorts of scientists from all over the country to come in and participate and be a part of it. And he did this for the greater good. And he rallied people to come together and work for a cause that was bigger than himself, for themselves. It was about humanity. It was about education. It was about science. And I think, David, if there's just one point I want your mm-hmm. audience to really take away, is that this film is about holding out a role model of someone who, in these divisive times, when things, there's so much meanness in the world these days, Mike Collins is a beacon of hope. Mike Collins, to me, is a role model for the kind of people we all ought to be. We ought to be working together, coming together, and doing things, right, even if it is selflessness.
All right, so I want to thank you so much, Olive Talley and John Loesch. The Stones are speaking, airs tonight at 10 p.m. on KLRN. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.